Thank you. Well, I want to first of all wish you all Happy New Year and thank you all for coming out on this yucky day. This is the opposite of sunny day. What I want to do today is I'm going to start out with real business, and we're going to talk about sort of the story so far, summary of last term, and then what we're planning to do this term. And I'm going to put off the announcements until then. And then before we get to three, we'll actually make the announcements, because by that time everybody will be here. Now, you need two handouts. If you didn't get them, there's copies here and copies in the back. Now, you could say that the major theme last semester was how does one cell make two? And maybe in a way it isn't any different this semester, except that the stress is going to be on eukaryotes instead of prokaryotes, etc. But to go back to last semester, we were interested primarily in how does one cell make two, and at another level, just how do things work, more than description. So you can say we were interested in prokaryotes. And when it comes to how does one cell make two and how do things work, we were interested in molecules, and in particular, macromolecules. Now, the big difference, to preview it, is this semester, we're going to be talking more about eukaryotes, and we're going to be talking about bigger things. And we'll come back to the details of this later. Now, it turns out, though, that the issues we were interested in last semester are not any different. We're going to be interested in the same issues, but we're going to have a slightly different model organism to talk about. But what were the big things that we interested in when we got to the question of how do things work, how does one make two? So we were interested, of course, in, if you talk about how does one make two, we were interested in manufacture. How does synthesis work? And then once you've got it, we were interested in the structure. And we were interested in function. And we were primarily interested in structure because in the structure lies the secret to function. Function is what we really care about, how things work, but we want to see how that is embodied in the structure or embedded. Now, it's not enough, as you know, just to make the right stuff and have it work. You have to make the right amount of stuff at the right time. So the other big issue was regulation. Now, depending on how you count, this is four: manufacture, structure, function, and regulation. And especially toward the end of last semester, we started thinking about one other issue, which we will talk more about this semester, which is the issue of origin. And I don't mean origin now, I mean evolutionary origin or historical origin. Not just how do things work, but how did they get that way, which is a question of evolutionary origin. Now, in addition to what I call the big five here, the big five questions, the other major issue we were concerned with last semester was how we know about these things. What are the methods that allowed us to figure this out? And that also is going to be the same this semester. Different methods, more of them, and using some of the ones from last time, but more methods. But again, we're going to be concerned very highly with how we know things and not just what we know. Now, what did we study? What particular areas were we interested in? Another way of summarizing this is to say what fields were we talking about? And we were talking about biochemistry and genetics and their fusion or collusion or collision, which is molecular biology. Now, what did we find out? We have the questions, we have the methods, we have what you call it. But what did we find out from all of this? And you could, in a way, summarize everything from last semester pretty much in what is called the central dogma, which is DNA makes RNA and RNA makes protein. That covers an awful lot. Now, I think to make this clearer as to what we were doing last semester, this is the way information flows, but it's also good to put this one in, because we were concerned both with replication, DNA replication, transcription, and translation. And we learned another very important thing, which is that it's actually the protein that does the job, usually, or does the work. And the job is often, but not always, a catalytic reaction, and we talked about how those work last semester. So you could say that this sort of summarizes what we learned. And if you want to add to this the issue of regulation, this process is regulated. We talked about operons and primarily regulation of this step. But to some extent, we talked about regulation of the job, about feedback inhibition, how you control not only how much protein is made, but how well the protein you have works. Now, the implication of this picture is that the only job of RNA is to make protein. We now know, and we alluded to it briefly last semester, that some small RNAs, especially in eukaryotes, may be involved in regulation per se. That they're not only regulatory proteins, they're regulatory RNAs. Now, we talked about it briefly last semester when we talked about RNAi. We didn't talk about it a lot, first of all, because it's primarily a eukaryotic issue, and also because it's a current area of investigation. This role of RNAs has only been discovered extremely recently. And so we really don't understand it, and that's one of the reasons I haven't talked about it that much. Now, at this point, I think it's worth looking at your handout that has no letters or numbers on it, that's labeled What Was Hot in 2010. This time of year, usually in December, the top science magazines usually make a list of great developments, great prospects, things of that sort. This year, Science Magazine didn't do it because they did the stuff for the decade instead of the year. It wasn't so interesting. But Scientific American had a list of 10 world-changing ideas. And one of the things that was so interesting is if you stretched it a little bit, something like 8 or 9 out of the 10 had to do with biology. And about 7 of them had to do with what we did last semester. That is, they were related to this foundational idea of DNA makes RNA, etc. And I've here given you some selections from it. If you want to see the whole thing, you have to go to the Scientific American website, which you can reach through the Columbia Libraries. Now, number one doesn't sound very biological. It says, computing human number crunchers. It turns out to be about the protein folding problem, that humans are better at seeing how to do it than computers are. The second one, which is biotechnology, the DNA transistor, is about a new way of sequencing DNA. One of the great hopes is that you'll be able to sequence DNA really cheap, so that every human will be able to sequence their own DNA and know what they should avoid, what they should worry about, etc. Now, I just read in the paper today that someone has done a study to see if those who get their DNA tested change their lifestyle. What do you think the answer is? No. So who knows how useful that's going to be, but we think it'll be useful in medicine, at least, to find out if people have certain susceptibilities and, for example, to avoid certain drugs. So the idea of this, without going into the details, is to take essentially a strand of DNA and pull it through a hole, and as it comes through the hole, to see, okay, A, G, C, T, etc. Now, on the other side, the one called health and medicine, in the meantime, since we can't do that, we can't sequence people's DNA easily, but we can look at sections in the DNA. And this is about doing testing. that testing for what are called SNPs, which is a kind of polymorphism. We talked about polymorphisms last semester, about restriction fragment length polymorphisms. These are called single nucleotide polymorphisms because one base in the DNA is different from one person to another. And some of these changes actually cause disease, and some of them, like the thing we talked about with Huntington's, is linked to a disease. And so tracing the inheritance of these so-called SNPs allows you to know whether people are at risk for certain diseases. And the point of this article is that rather than doing it one SNP or gene at a time, you do a whole bunch of them at once. So by doing one super test, you can find out, are you a carrier of 100 different mutations? And this is interesting because it represents a trend in biology and molecular biology in general from doing things one gene or one mutation at a time to doing them wholesale. Now, the final two, fuel and environment, we spent a lot of time talking about metabolism and how you convert one carbohydrate into another, how you break things down, how you get energy. And this is an idea here of taking genetically modified single-celled organisms and getting them to transfer the hydrogen and carbon-based molecules in trash into things you can put in a combustion engine. And the idea here is a combination of genetic engineering, which we discussed, and using single-celled organisms and altering their metabolism just enough. And the final one is about the importance of junk DNA. What we have called junk DNA means the stuff that doesn't code for proteins, which, as this may point out, is 98%. And one of the things junk DNA may code for is some of the small RNAs that regulate this process. But that, again, is something that's just now opening up. What is this extra DNA? And people are looking for a better name for it. But for now, it's called junk. Some people call it black matter DNA, an analogy with physics. Okay, so that's last term. So what are we going to do this time? Well, we're going to be concerned with the same questions and heavy reliance on methods, but we're going to be different organism, that is, eukaryotes, and we're largely going to be concerned with bigger things. Now, before we talked about DNA or RNA or protein, which can be pretty big, and a few assemblies like ribosomes, which combine them. But this time we're going to be talking about even bigger things, like organelles in the cell, separate areas bounded by membranes. And we're not going to be, so we're going to be talking about bigger structures inside cells, because eukaryotic cells are more complicated. And we're going to be talking about bigger in the sense of before it was one cell at a time, the organisms were unicellular. Now we're going to be talking about bigger assemblies of cells. You put them together into tissues, into organs, into systems, and into whole multicellular organisms. Now, the areas we're going to talk about this semester are going to be cell biology, signaling, development, and physiology. And these all are needed to understand two of the big innovations of eukaryotes. Or these come out of eukaryotic complications. If we go back, I'll put it up here again. What's the big deal with eukaryotes? Of course, the cells are bigger, but what's the big deal? There are two really big deals. One is that there are subcompartments within eukaryotic cells. There are areas surrounded by membrane that are separate from other parts of the cytoplasm. So it's like a house with multiple rooms instead of a one-room dwelling. So internal organelles or compartmentalization, whatever you want to call it, we have to understand what are those compartments, what do they do, how are they coordinated. And all of that is the subject of cell biology, the first thing I wrote there.
But we said
we weren't just looking at bigger things inside cells, organelles versus molecules. But we're also looking at things that have lots of cells at a time, not just one cell at a time. So multicellularity is the other, so to speak, big innovation. And all the other factors here, signaling, development, and physiology, are really all attempts to understand the consequences of multicellularity. Now, development is how you build a multicellular organism so that, say, the liver is in the right place, the head is in the right place, and so on. Physiology is about how you run the organism once you've got it. So development is about building it. Physiology is about running it. Now, there are whole courses in each of these things that I've written here, and we're only going to give you a taste of development. We're going to give you a few examples, ditto with physiology. We're only going to give a few details, and even with cell biology, we're only going to do the basics. Now, what's this signaling business? You could say signaling is interesting in of itself, and at times we've had a graduate course in it. But signaling is really interesting because it's needed in order to do development. In order to build an organism, one part has to be able to communicate with another. And in order to run the organism, same thing. The head has to know what's with the feet and vice versa. And so signaling is very important in understanding development and physiology, and we'll talk about it probably primarily in between the two of them. So it's sort of written out in here in the notes, and you can see from the syllabus sort of how we're going to do this. We're going to do cell biology first, largely, and then we're going to talk about regulation of gene expression, which is necessary to understand development. And Dr. Heitland is going to give 3 lectures on regulation of transcription and development. And then we're going to come back and finish any parts of cell biology we didn't have time to get to. And then we're going to talk about signaling. There's 2 kinds of signaling. There's chemical and electrical. And they overlap, as we'll see. We're going to talk about chemical first, and Dr. Feierstein, who is the current chair of the department and teaches part of neuro, is going to talk about electrical. Now, part of the reason for this schedule, the way it is the times when Dr. Heitland and Dr. Feierstein were available. As a result, we jiggled it a little bit beyond the obvious order. But the truth is, with biology, wherever you start is the middle. So we've done our best, and we will wrap it all up by the time we get to the end, but there is no real obvious order. Now, at the end of the class, we're going to be talking about physiology in the sense of how specific specialized cells, tissues, and organs get things done. And we'll pick only a few examples, but we'll do some of those in detail to see how it works at the molecular level. And then we're going to wrap it up with immunology, which is perhaps the most complicated of all interesting of all the systems. Now, because of the Jewish holidays, we're going to miss one class. And so rather than have a makeup that you have to come to, we are having an optional 25th lecture during study days. You don't have to come. It's not going to be on the exam, but I picked the sexiest possible topic in the hope that you will show up. And that topic is cancer. So if you want to know about that or get a preview of it, because we have a whole course on that too, you can come to the last lecture. That's at the end. Now, this is truly optional. You don't have to come, but you'd probably enjoy it. Okay. Now, this is basically what we did, what we're going to do. This is the plans. And before I actually get down to business and start with the cell biology, I want to stop for a minute and make some announcements. All of you probably know that the SURF Symposium is next Friday. Not this Friday, but next Friday. This is when undergraduates who have worked in the summer come and talk about their work. Some of them give talks, and the rest of it is a poster session. And if you haven't figured it out by now, you can get a few points of extra credit by coming. I strongly recommend that you go to the website for the course, you look at the extra credit section, and read it carefully and see what you have to do. And there is an option if you can't make it, but you have to tell us in advance. Now, for those of you who are undergraduates who want to do research in the coming summer, your application is due on February 1st. And since you need recommendations for professors, it is only kind to ask them fairly far in advance. So if you're thinking about doing this, you should start your application now, even though you don't have to wind it up till later, and you should ask professors for permission. The actual recommendations are online, but you should ask first. Now, these are my office hours today. I'll be having them regularly on Tuesday and Thursday, but the Thursday ones are later. No office hours on Wednesday, but if you can't make my regular hours, email me and we'll make an appointment. Now, there are a few other things I wanted to mention. The problem book is not yet ready. It will be ready by the end of the week. And I strongly feel that you don't need it until there's something to do a problem on, so I don't feel too guilty about that. But I've been going through it and fixing the typos so it's a little clearer. The other thing is recitation. For those of you in 2006, you need to sign up for recitation. There will be online forms hopefully tomorrow, if not a little later in the week. And as soon as they're ready, we will email you. We will also email you as soon as the problem book is ready. Now, that's really, I think, all I wanted about announcements. If there are administrative matters, you should probably either ask me after class or come next time with them or email me. And the thing I didn't mention, of course, is that I have the exams from last semester. Well, I don't have them in my hands, but Dr. Chazen will be bringing them at the end of class, and we will give them out. And if you don't pick them up, if you don't want to bother with the madness at the end of class, you can come after tonight's lecture. I will put them in the boxes outside my office, and you can come pick them up. If you would rather never see them again or trash them, that's understandable. We don't mind. Okay. So I guess I want to stop for a second and ask if there are any content questions, not administrative questions, that anybody has before we get down to business. Since I haven't said very much, there isn't any. So what I want to do now is stop talking about what I'm going to do and do it, which is to take a look at how does a eukaryotic cell compare to a prokaryotic cell. Now, we all know that a eukaryotic cell is much bigger. That there's a big difference in size. And there are actually some typical sizes given in your notes later if you want them for reference. That the typical eukaryotic animal cell is about 50 microns in diameter, but the typical bacterium is 1 to 5 microns. We'll explain what a micron is or remind you in a little bit. Now, if you look at these in the light microscope, which is the obvious thing to do, you don't see very much, of course, in the prokaryotic cell, but you'd think you'd see something in the eukaryotic cell. After all, it has these subcompartments, you ought to be able to see them. Well, if you look in the light microscope, you don't see very much. You see that there is a separate compartment in the middle called the nucleus, and the rest of the cell is called the cytoplasm. Now, I've drawn it with a barrier implied as a membrane around the cell and a barrier separating the cytoplasm from the nucleus. But the truth is, in the light microscope, you cannot see that there's a real structure there. All you can see is that there's different stuff on the two sides, so you can infer that there is a membrane, but you cannot actually see the membrane or the structure of the membrane. Now, what you can see is that inside the nucleus, there's an area that stains darkly, which is known as the nucleolus. And in the cytoplasm, you can see two kinds of organelles. If this is an animal cell, you can see mitochondria. If this is a plant cell, you can also see chloroplasts. These are actually about the same size as bacteria. I've drawn them a little smaller because of the way I drew my picture. But mitochondria and chloroplasts are about the same size as bacteria. So they're big enough to see in the light microscope, although you can't see what's inside them. Now, there's one other thing that you can see in the light microscope with certain stains. Its structure is quite hard to tell, and in fact, people just using light were not even sure it was real. But there did appear to be one other thing that was fairly large, stained in certain ways. It was named after its discoverer, the Golgi apparatus, known just as the Golgi. Now, what are these things? How do they work? How do they coordinate it? What's their structure, etc.? You would like to blow up this picture and see more and more. Well, the truth is, you can't. Why can't you just blow this up and increase the magnification? Well, you can't because the issue of resolution. If you are using light or any electromagnetic radiation, it has a fixed wavelength, which is usually known as lambda. If things are too close relative to this wavelength, they cannot be distinguished. They will look like one and not two, no matter how you blow it up. It just gets blurrier if you blow it up. And the limit of resolution is lambda over 2. If things are lambda over 2 apart, you can tell them apart. This, if they're any closer, you cannot. So this is the maximum distance things can be apart, and you can tell the difference. Anything closer than that, you can't resolve. So if you want to blow this up, you can't just increase the magnification. What you want to do is use a kind of radiation which has a shorter wavelength, thereby increasing the resolution or decreasing the distance that's significant. So what people do is instead of using the light microscope, they use a form of the electron microscope. They use a beam of electrons instead of a beam of light. Now, there are many other kinds of microscopes using all kinds of variations on this. We're not going to go into all of them. Becker has an appendix discussing many of them. But the electron microscope was invented in the 30s and used extensively in the 50s, and it's been very helpful in getting a better picture of what a eukaryotic cell looks like. Now, one way of looking at all this is what can you see with the eye versus the light scope versus the electron microscope? What's the limit of resolution? And what's a useful magnification? Now, you don't have to copy this down because it's in the notes if you want it. With the eye, the limit of resolution is about a tenth of a millimeter. And, of course, you haven't magnified things at all. That's the size they are. With the light microscope, in practice, it's about two-tenths of a micron. And that allows you to magnify things about a thousandfold. Now, there are actually two common variations on the electron microscope. There's the transmission electron microscope and the scanning electron microscope. In the case of the transmission electron microscope, which is what people mean when they just say electron microscope, it means that you're passing a beam of electrons through the sample. And just as with light, if it's electron dense, the beam doesn't get through. And if it's electron light, the beam goes through. So using this, it's 1 to 2 nanometers in practice. It's theoretically lower, but that's in practice, which allows you to get 100,000x. So that means you get about 100-fold more magnification than you get with the light microscope. Now, the scanning electron microscope is different. What you're doing is hitting the sample with electrons, and that beam of electrons causes other electrons to be bounced out of the sample, and then they hit things on the side and the back, and you record that. So you get what actually looks like a three-dimensional pattern from your sample. So this is used for larger items. It produces very nice pictures, but of slightly larger things. So it's, let's just say it's larger, and the answer is less. You get less magnification, and you have a larger limit of resolution, but you get a 3D picture. And if you look in your texts, you will see many pictures made by these two technologies, which are quite cool. And if you go to the issue of Scientific American, which has the great developments, it also has some beautiful pictures. I think they're mostly made with a light microscope, but there are all kinds of great biological things you would never think of looking at. Okay. Now, here we are talking about microns and nanometers, and you've probably forgotten what they are. So what are these things, and how are they related? So we want to do a brief summary of sizes. Some people have said that you can define biology by the size of the things that it studies. If things are too small, they shade off into chemistry. If they get smaller, they're physics. Forget it. If things get too big, physics again. The biggest things that biologists have to worry about, like blue whales and dinosaurs, can be measured in meters. We don't have to use kilometers for anything biological. Maybe for ecology, but not for the kind of biology we're talking about. So you can measure large animals like whales in meters. Now, a thousandth of that is a millimeter. And a pinhead is measured in millimeters, and very small organisms are measured in millimeters, like flies, things like that. So pinhead, perhaps, though, is the most thing you're most familiar with. Now, a thousandth of that is a micron, usually abbreviated mu, but it's micron. And cells, as we've noticed, are measured, their diameter is measured in microns. And you can see things with the eye that are millimeters in size. You can see things with the light microscope that are microns in size. Now, a thousandth of that is a nanometer. And now we're talking about cell parts, like organelles. And for this, you need the electron microscope. So the light microscope will help you with things of micron size, but you need the electron microscope for nanometer. When people talk about nanotechnology, they're talking about things that are measured in nanometers, usually no larger than 100 nanometers. Because if it's larger than that, you start talking about microns. So things that are 100 nanometers or less fall into the nanotechnology. Now, sometimes in cell biology especially, you will see things measured in angstroms. An angstrom is a tenth of a nanometer. Atoms, distances in macromolecules, sometimes those are measured in angstroms, but now we're shading off into chemistry. Chemistry uses angstroms all the time. Okay, so stuff in this range is a biological interest. We don't really need many larger or smaller units. Okay. So having said all of this, that in order to see what's really inside a cell, you ought to be able to tell, since everything is nanometer size, if you use the electron microscope. So what happens if you do? You want to look at your handout 1A, which has a diagram of what you can see if you use the electron microscope. First thing you can see in the electron microscope is that this structure here is real. There's really something here, the membrane. You can actually see its substructure. In standard electron micrographs, a membrane looks something like this. it has, if I blow it up, it has two dark layers and a light layer in the middle. Now, this is called a bilayer. It turns out to be two layers of lipid and associated protein. How they're organized, we'll talk about next time. But this is called a single membrane. Each membrane has two leaflets, but it's only one membrane. So one bilayer with its two halves is a single membrane. Now, why do we bring that up? Because some of the organelles are surrounded by two membranes. Remember we said that in the light microscope, it looks like the nucleus is surrounded by a membrane. Well, when you look in the electron microscope, you can see that it's actually surrounded by a double layer of membrane. Now, what this is equivalent to is if I had two layers and I punched some holes in it. And since I punched holes in it, this is where the hole is. Now remember, this is a cross section. So what this means is the membrane is continuous here. We've just sliced it at the level where the hole is. So there are multiple holes all around. And these are called nuclear pores. And this is a bilayer. This is the outer nuclear membrane. And this is also a bilayer. This is the inner nuclear membrane. But you have here two bilayers. So this is a lipid protein layer. This is another one. Two membranes, two bilayers. Now that means that there's a space in between the two of them. And that's sometimes called the perinuclear space. And it's clear from this picture that the space between the two nuclear membranes is continuous with a bunch of membranes and tubes in the rest of the cell, which is correct. We'll come back to this in a minute. Now, is there anything else about the nucleus that you can see in these pictures? You can see that it has two membranes. You can see the nuclear pores. You can see the perinuclear space. But remember the nucleolus? You can see that even in the light microscope. Well, you can see the nucleolus. And just as shown in your picture, it doesn't have a membrane around it. So this is the nucleolus. Now, this is not enclosed. This is actually a staging area where ribosomal subunits are put together. The point being that this is where certain supplies accumulate and are put together. So this is sort of a temporary pileup. This is not a separate organelle in the sense that it is not enclosed in a membrane. And if you stop making subunits, this will go away. Okay. Now, this is where you make ribosomal subunits. They are assembled from RNA made in the nucleus and proteins made in the cytoplasm. And how that works, we'll discuss another time. But notice I keep saying subunits. There don't appear to be any working whole ribosomes in the nucleus. All the ribosomes that are actually making protein are somewhere else. And some of them are just in the cytoplasm. That's what these little dots are meant to be. These are what are called free ribosomes. Now, they're attached to messenger RNA in making protein, but they are not attached to any of the membranes in the cell. That's why they're called free. Some of the ribosomes you can see are attached to membranes, like shown over here. Now, I've alluded to the fact that the space between the two nuclear membranes is connected to this larger network of membranes. This network of membranes, which takes a different shape in different cell types, and there can be more of or less of, is a collection of tubes and flattened sacs, and it's called the endoplasmic reticulum. Endo means within, plasmic in the cytoplasm, reticulum means network. Now it's abbreviated usually just as ER. Now it has different shapes and different parts, but there's one thing about it. You notice that it has this membrane on the outside, a single membrane, and then there's this space inside. Whenever you have an area with a space inside, the space is called a lumen. So the ER has a membrane surrounding it, and it has a lumen. Now the ER is usually divided into two parts. They're physically connected, and they're related, but they have somewhat different functions. One part has ribosomes on it, and one part doesn't. And therefore, the part with the ribosomes is called the rough ER, or the RER. But the part that doesn't have any ribosomes is called the smooth ER. Now, we'll look at this in more detail later. But the basic idea is the proteins being made on these ribosomes attached to the ER. When those proteins are made, they're going to wiggle into the lumen and from there go to their desired destination. On the other hand, proteins that are destined to go somewhere else, they're made on free ribosomes. Now, so the rough ER would be this part, and it's primarily for making proteins that are going to end up in the lumen. And we'll explain where they go from there. And the smooth ER is involved in other functions. For example, lipid synthesis is the enzymes of lipid synthesis are there. Cells that make a lot of protein that's going to be released from the cell have a lot of rough ER, because the proteins that are made attached to the ER and go to the lumen. From there, they can go to multiple places, but one of the places they can go to is the outside of the cell, as we will explain at length. Now, if you look at your cell here, you notice there are a bunch of other things here. There's a vesicle here, and to keep it simple, I only drew one. There are actually multiple kinds of vesicles in the cell. Let's write that over here to make it clearer. Every vesicle has a membrane around it, and you notice that this vesicle has only one single membrane, most of them do, and then it has a lumen. Now, there are many types of vesicles in the cell, and maybe we should list them now. Some of them are transport vesicles. They're carrying something around from one place to the next. Their name describes them. Some of them are what are called lysosomes. They contain enzymes that, if released, cause lysis or breakage open of cells. They are used to degrade and recycle things. Then there's a bunch called peroxisomes. Their shape and function varies from cell type to cell type, but they contain enzymes called peroxidases or oxidases. Both of these organelles contain enzymes for degrading, breaking down, and converting things. And both of these produce products or contain enzymes that you do not want floating around. And so by having them inside a vesicle, you put in the vesicle what you want to get treated, and you keep outside of the vesicle what you don't want touched. And the final class of vesicles we're going to be talking about are called endosomes. Now, these are just mentioned casually in your notes, and we won't talk about the details of them till later. But these are primarily sorting vesicles. Materials come into the cell from the outside. Materials are made in the cell, and often things are stuck together, and one piece is supposed to go one place, and one is supposed to go somewhere else, and the way they get sorted out is in endosomes. How that works, we'll talk about later. Now, in addition to vesicles, we have over here that thing, remember, we called the Golgi, or the Golgi apparatus. You can now see here what it really looks like. It is a series of flattened sacs. One way of thinking, this is sort of like a Mediterranean pita that has a lumen or a hole inside. So you have like a stack of pitas. And this is the lumen or the holes inside. And stuff is thought to move from one to the next as it gradually gets altered. We'll talk about that later too. And these vesicles are thought to be carrying material, debatable which way, but from one to another. So this whole thing together is part of the Golgi. Now, a lot of these parts, but not all of them, are considered part of one system. The endoplasmic reticulum, many of the transport vesicles, I'm going to write it over here, the ER, the Golgi, lysosomes, many transport vesicles, and others, but not peroxisomes, but the rest of it, these are separate. All of this stuff is considered to be part of one system of membranes and vesicles inside the cell. And so it's called the endomembrane system, or EMS, which I know has another meaning, especially to many pre-medical students. But this is called the endomembrane system. And why is it considered to be one system? You can see from this picture that some parts of it appear to be physically connected. The smooth ER is connected to the rough ER. But the vesicles, the ER, and the Golgi are physically separate. They are not connected. So why do people consider it all part of one system? Well, the reason for that is that they're functionally connected. They're not physically attached to each other, but material, both in the lumen and membrane, can be transferred from one to the next. And since you can move things around from any one part to any other part, although it's usually in one direction, that has led people to call it all one system. Now, what do we mean by moving things around and by being functionally connected? That's explained a little better or diagrammed on the bottom of handout 1A. So we want to look at this for a minute. So what we've drawn here are two membrane-bound areas within the cell. One of them has something inside it that's just symbolized here as X. If these are both part of the endomembrane system, then our pink X could actually be transferred from one to the other. And this is because of a property of eukaryotic membranes that prokaryotic membranes don't seem to have. And this is the ability to form vesicles. So what can happen, as you see in the next stage, is the membrane of the organelle we've called A can actually bulge out containing X. Now, to do this, to form a sort of pre-vesicle, requires special proteins to deform the membrane, pinch it off, etc., but we're ignoring those. Take cell biology, you learn all about those. So now what can happen is this little bulge can pinch off and form a vesicle. Now notice that the vesicle contains our pink stuff, which is often known as cargo. But it also contains a patch of membrane. And now, in the next stage, when the vesicle fuses, or starts to, with the target organelle, and eukaryotic membranes can both bulge out and deform and form vesicles, and they can also fuse. So these two membranes can fuse together, and that produces our final stage, which looks like this. And you notice that what we've transferred from A to B is both a patch of membrane and some cargo material. Now, this kind of process goes on all the time inside cells. And it is because of this, this has to be balanced, because clearly if this went all the time in one direction, then this cell, this organelle would just get bigger and bigger and more stuff with stuff, and this one would fall away. And in many cases, it's balanced either because it goes in the other direction or because this one then passes it on. Now, I said the other direction. I drew the arrows one way. Could it go the other way? Notice it's completely symmetrical. And so I could have drawn the arrows the other way and started with my cargo in B, had a vesicle form, butt off, be separate, and then carry the stuff over to A. So this could work either way. Now this process happens and allows the transfer of material, both membrane and cargo, from one part of the endomembrane system to another part of the endomembrane system. And it also happens between organelles and vesicles and the plasma membrane. Because this membrane is known as the plasma or cell membrane. Now, if you look a little more closely at your picture, you notice that we have three things written here. To make it clearer, I'm going to make this pink. What are we looking at here? Are we looking at material moving into the cell, or are we looking at material moving out of the cell? So I would like you to discuss this for a minute with the person next to you. Which is it? Or can't you tell? Maybe enough. Now we're going to take a vote. Going out, going in, or you can't tell. And I'm going to ask you to keep it honest. Just for a minute, close your eyes. Okay? So, how many people say it's going in? How many people say it's going out? How many people say you can't tell? Okay, you can open your eyes. So I would say the in and the out are about even. And a lot of people said, can't tell. So I'd say this is the majority. But a significant number said, in or out. If truth is, you can't tell. Cells do both. They take material from the inside and they send it out that way. They form a vesicle. But instead of going to another organelle, the vesicle goes up toward the plasma membrane, fuses with the plasma membrane, and instead of delivering the goods to another organelle, it delivers it to the outside of the cell. That's called exocytosis. Now, cells not only do that, but they take things in, and that's called endocytosis. In that case, material on the outside of the cell is captured by the forming in of a vesicle. The vesicle then pinches off, and now this vesicle can go and fuse with some part of the endomembrane system. So what we've just said is this could be like the outside of the cell. There's a vesicle forming, capturing stuff from the outside, and now it's inside the cell, and we can transfer it somewhere. Or we can take a vesicle from inside the cell, fuse it with the plasma membrane, and deliver it to the outside. Now, what's the point of this? Topologically, the lumens of all these organelles are equivalent. But they're equivalent to something else. They're equivalent to the outside of the cell. Things can move from the outside to the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum or the endomembrane system. They can move from the endomembrane system to the outside without ever really being loose in the cytoplasm. Cells that secrete proteins, the way they do it is the protein is made on a ribosome attached to the ER. It goes into the lumen of the ER through a transport vesicle to the lumen of the Golgi, to usually some other kind of vesicle, which we will go into, usually called a secretory vesicle, which comes up here to the plasma membrane and releases the goods. And we will talk about this process in detail later. Now, I want to talk now. We've talked about transport vesicles, and I mentioned secretory vesicles, which are a kind of transport vesicle, but instead of carrying things, say, from the Golgi to the ER, they're carrying things to the membrane to release them. And we also mentioned, though, lysosomes and peroxisomes, and I want to talk about them next. But before I do that, let me ask if there are questions about the stuff so far. Yeah. Given what I've said, are all the lipid membranes the same? They are not the same either in lipid or protein composition, and the two halves of a bilayer are not necessarily the same, and we'll talk more about that, how you keep it from getting all mixed up. Yeah?
Are the terms endo and exocytosis only when you're dealing with the outside of the cell, or what about like between organelles?
The terms endo and exocytosis are only used from entering and exiting the cell. They're not used for transport within the cell between organelles. That would be called intracellular or interorganellar transport. Yeah?
Can you talk about vesicle formation? Can they come off of any part of the EMS, like including the Golgi, or is it...
Can vesicles come off any part of the EMS? It's possible, but there are certain parts where it seems to happen primarily, probably because the proteins that allow the formation of vesicles are there. And we'll talk more about that, what the usual progression is. Okay. Now, we mentioned two other kinds of vesicles, called peroxisomes and lysosomes. And I want to say a word about them. We said that one of them is considered part of the EMS, the endomembrane system, and one of them is not. Now, the reason for that is this is part of the endomembrane system. Peroxisomes are not. This is largely because of origin. When you follow the proteins through the cell or the lipids that end up in one or the other, they come from different places. Also, lysosomes are connected functionally to the rest of the endomembrane system, and peroxisomes are not. Now, we mentioned already that they're similar in function, and that what they do is to segregate something dangerous, keep it safe inside a membrane. In the case of lysosomes, it's the enzymes that degrade things. In the case of peroxisomes, it's both the enzymes that oxidize things and the reactive products that are generated by those enzymes. It doesn't matter what the exact details is. The point is that both of these sequester dangerous stuff. And both of them look about the same. They both have a single membrane. Now, that's compared to mitochondria. You notice there's a mitochondrion over here in your picture, and it has two membranes. But peroxisomes and lysosomes have a single membrane, single bilayer. And they're about the same size, and they're about the same density. The density of an organelle depends on the ratio of lipid to protein. If the proportions are the same, the density of the organelle will be about the same. So the obvious question is, are there really two different organelles? Maybe there's really only one. Where do we get the idea there are really two? How do we actually know what the properties of the different parts of the cell are? How do we know what enzymes are where? There are two basic methods that people use. In your notes, these are at the end for reference, but I want to mention them now. One is a biochemical method, which I think we referred to last semester, and is often known as grind and find. And the other is more of a cell bio or molecular bio method, which is called in situ, which means in place. Now, the idea of grind and find is that you take your cells and you break them open, usually by mechanical means at one time. Sometimes you actually use a mortar and pestle. That's where the grind comes from. So you break open the cells mechanically, and then using the methods we talked about last semester, primarily ultracentrifugation, you separate the parts. Now, using an ultracentrifuge, you can separate things on the basis of size by using sedimentation velocity, or by density using equilibrium density centrifugation. So that allows you to separate many of the parts of the cell. For example, you can break the cell open, and you can separate the nucleus from what's left of the ER. It tends to break into small pieces, but you can separate the two. They're different in size, they're different in density. That's easy. Then how do you know what you've got? How do you know what enzymes are associated with the endoplasmic reticulum? After you break the cell open and separate the parts, you can take the parts or the fractions or the test tubes that now contain endoplasmic reticulum. And you can now assay for what enzymes are there. You can supply substrate and ask, does it get made into product? So using these methods, you can identify which enzymes or enzymatic activities are associated with many of the different parts of the cell. For example, DNA polymerase, of course, with the nucleus, lipid synthesizing enzymes with the ER. But what about these two? Using these methods, you cannot separate them from each other because they are identical in size and density. But the other method allows you to tell them apart. Now, in situ means in place. And the idea there is that you take cells, spread them out, and provide soluble substrate. So here is your cell, and here is, say, your organelle. And you provide soluble substrate. Now, the enzyme that modifies that substrate is in here. Here's where the enzyme is. So nothing happens to this substrate. There's no enzyme to change it. But this, any substrate that gets in here will be acted upon by the enzyme and converted to product. And the trick to this is the substrate is soluble and the product precipitates. It's insoluble. So as soon as any product forms, it precipitates and sits where it is. And now you can wash out any remaining substrate, and all that's left is the insoluble product. And if I were to do that here, where would I find product? Suppose the enzyme that converts substrate to product is in here. Will I have any product out here? The only place I'll have product is here, because the product formed there and stayed in the place in which it was formed. So this allows me to identify where the enzyme was because of its ability to convert substrate soluble to product insoluble. So using this technique, you can see that there are two classes of vesicles in the cell. One contains oxidases, and a different one contains degradation enzymes. These are two different sets of enzymes. One set of substrate is converted to product here, a different substrate to product here. Are there questions about this business? Yeah. What's the difference? These are different locations. Right. So if you looked at a real cell, you wouldn't see one of these. If you looked at a real cell, there would be many vesicles. If you provided substrate for peroxidases, some of them would stain with product, but not others. And if you provided a substrate for the degradation enzymes, a different set would form product. Now, we have one more organelle here we didn't talk about, and that is the mitochondrion. Now, you heard about the function and somewhat the structure of mitochondria last time. And we've already mentioned that plant cells contain not only mitochondria, but chloroplasts. And chloroplasts are similar in some ways in structure and function. That both mitochondria and chloroplasts are major players in eukaryotic energy metabolism. Both of them have at least two membranes, and in one of their inner membranes, they both do the same thing. They have an electron transport chain, and as a result, they generate a proton gradient. And then the protons coming back through an ATP synthetase make ATP. So this is the same for both mitochondria and chloroplasts. And in the space, one of the spaces in the middle, there are like the matrix of the mitochondrion and an equivalent space in the chloroplast. They are actually rearrangements of carbon compounds. So there's synthesis of carbon compounds. With chloroplasts, it's the fixing of CO2, the converting of it into glucose. In mitochondria, it's the Krebs cycle. And this is driven by the ATP generated by electron transport. Now, both of these are big energy players, but there's a big difference. Where do mitochondria get the energy to push electrons, which in turn pushes protons. Is it the same as with chloroplasts? Chloroplasts use light energy to drive this whole thing. But mitochondria use the breakdown of reduced compounds in order to drive this whole thing. So it's when one case it's oxidation of reduced compounds in mitochondria, and it's light energy that's used in chloroplasts. Now I want to remind you that plants have mitochondria also. They have both. We unfortunately have only mitochondria. Someday somebody will figure out how to put the chloroplasts in, and we'll have solar panels. But not yet. Okay. Now we also mentioned that both mitochondria and chloroplasts have at least two membranes and are about the size of bacteria. Now it goes further than that. Both of them have DNA inside. They have a small amount of DNA, but they have DNA. And they have what's called an entire genetic system. That is, they don't just have DNA. They have everything you need to use that DNA to make proteins. That means that they can not only replicate the DNA, but they can carry out the whole central dogma. They have the enzymes for transcription and translation. So they can use this DNA to make proteins. They contain enzymes, ribosomes, tRNA, etc. Both the DNA, the ribosomes, and many other features of this system resemble very strongly that of prokaryotes. Now, putting all of this together, along with other evidence, we've come to the conclusion that mitochondria and chloroplasts are the descendants of free-living bacteria. They were captured by the ancestors of eukaryotic cells. And so that mitochondria and chloroplasts are what are called symbionts. That is, they live inside eukaryotic cells. They get benefit, and the cell gets a benefit. Now, what has happened is that over time, millions of years, most of the DNA of these organelles has been lost. They only have a little bit left, and they code for proteins that are very hard to move around, usually very lipid-soluble. They code for some of their own genetic system materials, and they code for certain subset of proteins. But where do most... So there are a few ribosomes in here. So this means there's actually three categories of ribosomes in a cell. There's the free ribosomes in the cytoplasm, outside of organelles. There's the ribosomes inside mitochondria or chloroplasts. And there's the ribosomes attached to the ER. Where do most of the proteins in a mitochondrion or a chloroplast get made? It turns out almost all of the proteins are made here on free ribosomes. So what that means is there's only a little DNA in here coding for a few proteins that are made inside. Most of the proteins are made outside. Where is the DNA coding for them? It's in the nucleus. So most of the genes for making most of the proteins of these organelles is in the nucleus. The organelle version has been lost. But the organelles maintain the DNA to make a small subset of proteins that apparently are not easily made outside and imported. And the issue of regulation here comes up. When you look at the electron transport chain, some of the proteins involved here have subunits where one subunit is made inside the mitochondrion and one subunit is made in the cytoplasm. And clearly this has to be coordinated so that you have the right number of the appropriate subunits. So regulation is not just a problem of a single protein, a single peptide, and a single genetic system, but of multiple peptides, multiple genetic systems. Now, there's only one more piece of the cell that I want to mention. We're going to talk about it mostly next time. And this piece is not shown. Because when you do a standard electron micrograph, you can't see it. And this is the cytoskeleton. Underlying all of this is a web of filaments and fibers that are providing both mechanical support and holding these things in place, and to some extent allowing for transport, say, of vesicles from one part to another. And this structure, which is called the cytoskeleton, and also which allows the cell to move, is composed of three components that are called microtubules, microfilaments, and intermediate filaments. Microtubules, you don't have to worry about the details of this because we'll talk about it next time. Microtubules are hollow, the filaments are solid, and they're called intermediate filaments because they were discovered last and they're in size in between the other two. The top two are involved in movement, the third one only in support. And what their structures are and how they work is what we'll talk about next time. Now, I'm going to stop here, and Dr. Chazen is here, and we have the exams from last semester for all the different classes, and if there are any TAs here, please come and help. And we will give out the morning exams first, and then, if you're still here, the afternoon exams. Go back there because it'll be a little easier. And Larry has L through P, and Chris and Leah are going to have the evening class.
Boy, lucky us.
Okay, so that's in this box. But what you should do is each take half of the, each take a piece of the alphabet, three of you. Okay, and then just have people tell you, okay? Okay, Chris has the PM class A through D. He's going to go in the back, I think.
E through K.
Jason has E through K. But I guess they gave up. Okay, what's your last name then?
Sims. S-I-M-S.
Sorry, how do you spell that?
Valerie?
Yeah.
With a Q?
Only in the
morning.
didn't say the Anna part.
Yeah. Sorry.
Ullman, U-L-L-M-A-N.
U-L-L?
Yep.
Stacy?
Yes.
Not too good on alphabet. Jenny? Yeah, hold on a second. We'll find everything, but it's going to take us a while. Alice? No, this is two. Shepherd? Kyle?
Stephanie Charles.
Charles? CH?
Yes, CH.
I don't have C, I have Q through Z.
Okay, so where can I find the PN? But, you know?
I'm not sure who has. Jenny has some of it.
I think it's with K.
I have Q through Z in the evening. TS? Lauren? Sarah?
Yeah.
I have the evening class, Q through Z. I'm not. Who has the evening class at the beginning? Evening?
Chris in the back.
He has the morning.
I've got.
What do you have?
I have morning class, but I did everyone.
Okay, so just put those back then. And so you have the evening class too, right?
Morning.
Okay. Let's see. He has. I don't know what he has, but he has some of them. Okay. Let me finish with the Q through Z's, and then we'll try and find the rest. What evening? Evening. Q through Z. What? Okay, Rose. Alex?
Thompson.
David?
Wong? Chris Wong.
I think it's Q through Z for the evening.
Are you in the evening class?
Yes.
I have a different W-A-N-G? W-O-N-G. Chris? Q through Z in the evening? I don't have B. Q through Z. Say it again.
It'll be
Suspect. Hillary? I don't have B. I only have Q. It's somewhere, but I don't know.
Well,
I have
who
Q.
Who has M in the evening?
I don't know. He has some of it, but I don't know where the rest of it is. And he has some at the back, but I don't know where the rest of it is. We're sorry. Q through Z, anybody?
Simonson.
Joseph?
Yes.
Q through Z in the evening.
It's either there or
Q
there.
Q through Z in the evening?
See those groups of people?
Okay. Sorry, is that
the
group?
No.
I have Q through Z.
T-O-R-E-S.
Yeah, I'll help you in a second with the question. Yeah. Tanya?
Thank you.
So, for recommendation?
I went around to my parents who has evening class S.
Okay. Oh, he does.
Oh.
Adrian Swazza.
You got a question?
Yes. I was wondering, I was not in this class the fall semester, but I still be in this class this semester.
What have you had so far?
In terms of bios? I'm not really sure. But the stuff we covered today is...
Well, I know. The stuff we covered today is not a big deal, but...
Okay.
If you have never had the equivalent of molecular biology type stuff, I wouldn't recommend it. There are people who do it sometimes and are okay, but most of the people who do it say, how do I ever get into it? Now, have you... There's a sample exam, I think. If not on this website, on the previous one, change the 20. You know about 206, right?
Yeah, this is 206.
Change the 6205.
Okay.
Get the website. Go to the exam section, or go to those lectures, and be sure you had some of that stuff.
Right.
Because if you hadn't, I don't recommend it. What are you in college? GS?
Yeah. But I'm a professional.
Normally, did you take AP Bio?
Yeah.
It might be all right.
I was talking with the principal beside me, and they're like, normally freshmen don't even take bio.
They don't, but an occasional student does, and sometimes it's okay. Do you have a backup plan?
I guess I'd join the camp. Or...
I would recommend attending both for the first week or two so you see what's happening. But also take a look at last semester, and if you know all that stuff, then don't worry about it.
Sounds good. All right.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Yeah, okay.
I need to search for an Orgo lab, but it conflicts with this nighttime time, so I have to get it overrided by the star.
Oh, yeah.
And I said that if I could get your...
So fill it out. We don't have to sign one of these. It overlaps like for 10 minutes or something, yeah. That's right. Hi.
I'm sorry, I wanted to wait for my grain, obviously, before. But is that okay?
That's all I need.
Okay, thank you so much.
Oh, wait. K-O-S-K-E-Y? Yeah, that's out of
order. I have questions. So before we said that there are no actual ribosomes in the nucleus, even though there are all those units in the nucleolus, does that mean that they're assembled and they're carried out, or that they're not assembled at all?
Well, they don't get the two subunits don't come together to make a whole ribosome until they attach to a message.
Okay. So it's just then the units coming together to make the subunits for the ribosomes.
The proteins and RNAs that are in a single subunit come together, but the two subunits don't come together.
Okay. Is it ever the case that the membrane is the cargo if you're trying to get the protein?
You could look at it that way, but it's not that the membrane isn't what you want to transfer. It's just that people distinguish between membrane proteins and soluble proteins by calling them cargo. So, Larry, what do you want to do with this? You want to give them back to me so I can take them tonight?
Yeah, I'll put them all in my box.
If they'll fit, yeah, sure.
Hey, microphone.
Yeah, let me turn it off. Oh, I forgot to turn off the recorder. That's the real problem.